everybody. Welcome to the Faber Podcast. We are on a break, but I had this very wonderful discussion with a fellow pediatrician about abuse in the community of disabled children. And I think I learned a lot, and I wanted you to hear the conversation that we had and connect with you. And please tell me if you have any comments, if you have any questions, if you know any disabled child who is being abused or neglected, please report to your nearest children's officer. Till next time, bye-bye.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone who's going to take their time to watch this. Now, listen to this. 1 in 20 children have some form of disability, either moderate disability or severe disability. And the worst part is these children with disability are 4 times more likely to be abused, any form of abuse. And that means in every 3 children who have disability, 1 is suffering some form of disability, as compared to the children who do not have any form of disability, 1 in 10. And the worst and the most sad thing is 80% of the abusers are actually their parents, the people they trust, either their biological parent or their caregivers, but it's the people who have the responsibility of taking the primary care for these children. Now, it's because of this we have opted to do this video. And as you think of those numbers, we allow Dr. Karibu to introduce herself, and then you go to the depth of the discussion. Dr. Karibu.
Asante sana, Dr. Neema. My name is Dr. Lilian Kerubo. I am a practicing pediatrician in Kenya, and I also run a practice that raises awareness on child development and behavior based in Nairobi.
Yeah, thank you. And for those who are not so new, Dr. Kerubo is literally one of our main guests because of the depth of knowledge that she shares. And I'm sure you're going to appreciate this. So, Daktari, those numbers are disturbing. Actually, when I was researching about this, I was like, what? Why? Yeah. Why is it so bad? So maybe to start with is, which type of disabilities are more likely to suffer some form of child abuse?
Yes. Thank you for highlighting those numbers. I didn't know it was one in 20 has a disability and 80% of them are getting abuse. That is very sad and very, very discouraging.
Yeah.
So all children with disabilities, when we talk about disability, we mean any challenge that prevents a child from participating fully in the social or activities around them. So be it something that will prevent education, something that may prevent playing outside, something that may prevent them walking or transporting themselves to a certain place, something that can prevent them from eating or from basically enjoying life as it ought to be experienced, that's a disability. So there are many types of disabilities. We have physical disabilities, for example, somebody who doesn't have an arm or whose legs are not able to transport them. We have cognitive or intellectual disabilities where somebody has a difficulty understanding. And we have non-physical disabilities like hearing disability, speaking disability, visual loss, and all types of disabilities. We even have behavioral and emotional disabilities where the mind is working. However, the way the child processes information and how the child responds to the environment may be a challenge for them to experience life as it's supposed to be experienced. So out of those, I think what I feel is the most puts children at biggest risk of abuse are the cognitive disabilities. The disabilities that affect the brain, how the brain functions, how the brain processes information, and how the child is able to then use that information to make a decision or go forward in life. And this is because the brain controls everything. The brain will control how you walk, how you talk, how you understand, what you remember, how people will see you. And I think a child who has a cognitive or an intellectual disability is at all children are at risk, but the one who I think has a cognitive or intellectual disability disability might be the one who is at most risk.
And I'm imagining that would be so also because of, you know, people won't believe what you, when you say something.
Like exactly.
Just say no, we are kona shida, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe you're just doing your own things and that makes sense because even for a parent, you're more likely maybe to mistreat this child simply because you kind of think kona semaga ni cheesy. I don't know. You're called mwenda azimu simply because they think just whatever you're saying really doesn't make sense. And that is so sad. That is really sad.
Yeah.
So how are these children abused? Which type of abuse is common now?
Yes. So I was reading an article yesterday by a group called Enable Me Kenya. Mm-hmm. And I think the commonest form of abuse in all children, including the disabled children, is actually neglect.
Okay.
Just neglect, not taking the right care of these children, feeding them what they're supposed to be fed, nutritious food, not protecting them, not giving them shelter, not giving them access to education, access to clean water, access to toilet. Sanitation, access to a playground, because those are basic human rights or basic chances. So when these are denied, then you are neglecting the child. So the highest form of abuse that children face, including disabled children, is neglect. And then we have other forms of abuse. We have physical. You find that disabled children are usually beaten even harder than others because maybe the person doing the beating is so frustrated with them and now the beating is too much or they're being beaten for no reason or, you know, they're being beaten just because we have sexual abuse. And again, those with intellectual disabilities are easily sexually abused because, as you've said, nobody will believe them. Maybe they don't even have vocabulary to say what happened. Maybe they don't even have the presence of mind to realize what has just happened to me. Then we have emotional abuse where you keep calling the disabled child bad names, like you mentioned. Some of them are called wenda wazimu. Some of them are called freaks of nature, curses, or punishment for somebody's sin. In my community where I come from, where when there's a disabled child, you'll find somebody being accused of having practiced witchcraft. And so more often than not, yes, the mother of that child or the parent of that child may be chased away because they believe they have practiced witchcraft. That's why the child is disabled. That's a form of emotional or mental abuse. The commonest I would say is neglect.
It's a neglect. Yeah, which is, as you said, it's the same for the kids who also don't have special needs. Now, I know you've mentioned some. Why is it so difficult? Why is it that kids who have special needs, who have challenges, are more likely to be abused? As you said, some is because of how they are, but then what are the challenges? Why is it now we are not able to really be able to protect them, especially it's coming from the parents? Because as we said, 80% of the abusers are actually parents, either biological or caregivers, or what is usually the problem? You said you talked about frustration, you talked about just doing things because maybe you think that is the best way. What is usually the challenge here?
So I think there is obviously going to be a mismatch, especially with those who have cognitive disability. There's going to be a mismatch between the parental expectation and what the child can deliver as far as what the parent wants. So, for example, if let me use an example of a child who has a parent who has a child with cerebral palsy. And so the understanding and the communication of that child has been affected. So perhaps the parent, you know, grew up knowing when I send this child for a cup, they should be able to bring that cup to me. Maybe this child is 2 years, they don't comprehend the instruction that they've been given. And so that mismatch will create tension in the home. And if it's not addressed, if it's not, if the parent is not empowered to find ways that she can communicate, she or he can communicate to the child in a way that he can understand, then that will create tension. And you know, tension will have to be released at some point, just like a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
And more often than not in our African setups, that tension comes in the form of physical violence. So I would say one of the causes of abuse is that mismatch between what the society expects of the child and what the child can deliver. Another reason why why disabled children are at high risk of abuse is the fact that most of them, most of the parents or the caregivers, when they realize that they have a disabled child, obviously it's nobody's wish to have a disabled child. And so this child becomes like a point of failure or a disappointment or, you know, something that you're not happy about. And so it's easy to say, after all, I didn't want this type of problem in my life. I didn't want this burden in my life. So, you know, there's little care for whatever happens. So you, if it's food you are giving, but you are not like giving the right foods, or sometimes you withhold foods, because after all, it's a burden to your life. And then another reason is the fact that we don't empower both the caregiver and the child to know what exactly constitutes abuse and what it's, you know, like when we get, and this happens to all parents, even those with children who are not disabled. Very few parents have been told that actually this is abuse, you're abusing your child, you know. Or even if they've been told, maybe they didn't understand. So that lack of empowerment, that lack of capacity building also makes children who are disabled to be at risk of abuse. And then of course, the structures surrounding this disabled child, of more often than not, disabled children are left to be in the house alone. Nobody's watching over them. Most people don't think that they should go to school. The parents, if they are poor, they have to go look for money to take care of the household. So, and hiring a nanny is expensive. And even nannies will come, and when they see a disabled child, 1 month, 2 months, they are gone. So even getting steady support to protect that child in case, you know, the abuse is from outside, it's usually lacking. And then, of course, limitations of the child. Is this child able to understand when abuse has taken place? And once they've understood abuse has taken place, are they able to say, and who do they report to? And when they report, what happens? Do we leave them? Do we protect them? Do we stop that abuse from happening? Especially if it's from the parent. What structures are there to protect this child from that parent? Are there homes? Are there foster homes that we can take for safety, to move them the situation? So all those factors, plus more cultural and social norms, as I've mentioned, some people in my community will send away this parent or this child who has a disability because they believe somebody is practicing witchcraft. You know, some people, a few years back, there was a problem in Tanzania where they were killing all the albino children because they believe the albino has power or something like that. They were killing them.
Yeah. You know,
social and cultural norms that are actually abusive to children.
So how do we equip, maybe we could start from, how do we equip these parents so that they're able to know where do they draw the line? Because I know having a child with disability is not easy.
Yeah.
So how do parents now navigate through that so that at the end of the day, they do the best they can for this child as much as they themselves also remain in check?
Yes. So I think there should be a form of education before parenting, even before you get pregnant.
That's what I always say.
So, like, even when kids are like when they start our adolescence towards teenagehood, because we are getting a lot of teenage pregnancies and teenage mothers, and that's another factor, by the way, the development and maturity of the parent also determines how they will choose the child. So I think parenting and how to treat a child are lessons that should start very early. And they don't have to go to school to be taught this. For example, like when, even as let's say you have older children who is like, one is 9 years, and then maybe the mother gets pregnant with a newborn. Then lessons on how to take care of a baby should start at that point. You should start showing this 9-year-old, this is how you carry a baby, this is how you feed a baby, this is how you know that a baby is hungry, this is how you protect the baby from, you know, strangers or people who may not have the best interests of the child at heart. So those are small lessons that can be built up, so that now when the child is in adolescence and in high school, then now we about basic human rights, regardless of whether there is disability or not. And then when now this person is grown, you know, as we are preparing them for transition into adulthood, we have chats with them and we tell them, you know, yes, it's good that, you know, you're growing. One of these days you might become a parent. This is how you treat a child. This is what constitutes abuse. This is what constitutes neglect. This is what constitutes, you know, proper parental care. And you alert, you know, future parents. Of course, most parents don't want to be told they might have a disabled child, but it's a reality. Do not know what type of child that you will have. We all hope for a child who does not have additional needs. That's what we all hope for. But it happens. We need to tell parents that it's possible this can happen, and if it does, be mindful of, you know, how you talk, what you withhold, how you punish, how you correct behavior. Be mindful, you know, the type of school that, you know, this child is sent to, you know, just as a preparation. And then, of course, once the child has come, and we notice as doctors or as healthcare workers that this is probably a child who might require extra supports as they grow up, then that's the time now we have a very serious sit down with the parent, beyond just telling them, okay, this is probably a child who will need therapy, this is a child who might be on medication for life, this is a child who may need a wheelchair. In add to that, now this is how to treat this child. Watch out for you know, frustration in yourself, you know, deal with the grief. I was told by one of my mentors that when a parent discovers that they have a disabled child, they should be allowed to mourn the child they thought they would have. So allow that grief period, just like when you lose a parent or when you lose somebody, you are allowed a mourning period. Let them mourn the loss of the child they thought they would
they
have.
Thought they were going to have,
so that they accept the child that they have. Because if that is not allowed, then that frustration and that tension builds in you, and then it will be meted out against the child. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that we live in a country that does not have legal structures, strong legal structures to protect disabled children. Because in other countries, you don't even have to be educated about this. You just know that if you don't do what is right for that child, you just go to jail.
The other day,
I saw a mother who had been jailed for life because she didn't feed her child. She was not feeding her child properly, so the child died of malnutrition. She went to jail. In other countries, it's not even a discussion. Like, nobody will come to say, oh, you know, you are abusive, please reduce it. Police will just show up on your door and they will say, we have been told this child is not being fed, we have been told this child is not going to school, we have been told this child is not being, the diapers are not being changed on time, you are being arrested. You know, but now because here in Kenya we don't have strong legal structures, because now you wonder, if you arrest the child, then where does that, if you arrest the parent, where does that child go? Who will even have that child? So
And then the existence of economy is so bad, as long as you have the things to treat the child with, then they can do.
So I think education you know, just that mentorship, education, that awareness, creating that awareness that even as parents, we might be abusive to our children. Yeah, we'll go a long way in changing behavior.
Yeah. I like the fact that you mentioned about mothers and fathers being told about parenting before they have children. It's one of the things I'm really looking into doing, and maybe we'll talk about this. But I think that's where it all starts, because I think most of us, if you grew like, okay, at least at my age, it was like getting children was a part of life. Like, you really never stopped to think, do I really need the children? Will I be able to take care of them? What's the implication in my personal life when it comes to children? And I think that's one of the education that we really need to give our children, especially now we have teenage pregnancies. You just think, okay, now I'm getting pregnant. And unfortunately, it's the girl child who gets to suffer the most, because now they'll have to get pregnant for 9 months. Now they'll have to stop schooling because now they have to breastfeed a child. Then if they're lucky enough, they'll continue. But most usually, that's usually ends everything they've ever dreamt of. Yeah, it's a lot. Okay. It's a lot. So how do we tell a child is actually being abused, especially a special needs child who has all these challenges that you've mentioned? Because before I taking a step to report or to maybe go assist a certain family, there are things that I need to pick. There are things that I may need to pick. So which are these things that I will see or observe that may say, okay, maybe something is actually off with this parent or with this child or this family?
So the good thing is that majority of the disabled children, unless they have a cognitive or a communicative challenge, majority will be able to say. For example, if it's a physical disability, they should be able to understand that something happened, and they should feel safe to report. So just like with all other children, then you need to start talking to the disabled children very early about privacy, private parts, who can touch, who cannot touch, what constitutes violation. So that a child who is able to understand, let's say a child who perhaps has a amputated leg, that should not stop them from coming to say, so-and-so touched me, or so-and-so said this to me that I don't think is right. So the challenge comes with those with cognitive or communication disability. We will have to devise ways for them to be able to communicate what has happened. If it means drawing pictures, maybe they understand pictorial information, it may mean you draw pictures for them, and then you tell them, when this happens, you know, reports. When this happens, come tell me. So that at least the child tells you in advance, before you go and start looking for clues. The child, the one should realize something has happened that is not right, and then they self-report. That would be the best scenario. However, some, depending on the degree of disabilities, some may not, because there are those who are in an institution. Let's say, you know, we read a story the other day about a girl who had been in an institution for many years. Yes, she had a disability. She was being abused by the nurse, sexually abused by the nurse in that institution. And so they only discovered it when she got pregnant, of course. So she got pregnant, but she's comatose. She's not even fully conscious. She's confined to the bed. She's not speaking. Nobody could tell something is happening. Yeah. And I imagine parents probably were going there maybe once a week. Institutionalized, and the nurse of that institution took advantage of the child. They only realized when the girl got pregnant that it was a big case in the United States. I think the nurse got jailed. So for those types of situations where really we don't expect the child to
say anything,
then we should be, as parents, we should be noting any slight changes in behavior or in mood or in physical appearance, you know, those small clues Like if somebody maybe is jovial, even like children with cerebral palsy, even the severe cerebral palsy, they're usually jovial. They're very, very smiley, happy. So when you notice that degree of happiness is reducing, just, you know, start looking for clues of where they could be. For children who, you know, maybe they are nonverbal, the severe autism that is nonverbal, cannot say any word, then, you know, find maybe a picture or give them a paper where they can draw or they can arrange a doll in a particular position. Maybe this is something that maybe they either saw or
something
was done to them. And then sometimes we have to do regular checks, you know, even with non-disabled children. Sometimes just, you know, ask for consent and open and check. You know, of course, this is for sexual abuse. You know, just regular checks every month or every 2 weeks. Just, you know, ask for consent and then check. Because sometimes you wait for them to say, they may not say because maybe they didn't realize. So just check their private parts for girls, you know, check for tears, check for breathing, check for, if you know how to locate the hymen, check if it's still present. For boys, check for tears, both in the penis and the anal region, check for bruising, you know, and then even as you're preparing to check the way they will behave towards you, can tell you what has gone on. Like if your daughter, usually you ask for consent and they say, okay, mommy, but this time they're like, oh no, mommy, it's painful, or, you know, they're acting like they're folding themselves up, they don't want anybody to, you know, approach them in that area, then that can be a clue that perhaps something has happened. So just frequent and regular checks, even for the ones in institutions, we can get a chaperone, and the parents can, every 2 weeks, in the presence of a chaperone, check and say, okay, look at the skin, are there any bruising? Look at the, you know, look at the arms, like they are staying in one fixed position for long, because that could mean that maybe threw them down or hit them so bad. Maybe they suffered a fracture. Look at the, look at the hidden areas, you know, the underarms and the inner thighs, because people are usually pinched or hurt there because it's not easy to pick it up. So just frequent checks that, you know, you don't need somebody to tell you something happened. Just do a regular check, follow up and check. Especially for children who cannot communicate or who don't have the presence of mind to know what exactly
happened.
Yeah,
that is scary. That's very, very scary, actually. Not only for kids who have special needs, but even just thinking that someone can actually, like, for example, that story of a nurse. I mean, it's disturbing. Yeah. It's really disturbing. Is. So is there a way we can prevent this as we wind up? Is there a way we can prevent this?
Yes. The first way is to be aware that these things are happening. You know, most of the time, like in the hospital, when a child is brought that they have been sexually violated, the parent is usually even shocked that such a thing can happen. And you'll find the child is being brought maybe 2 to 3 weeks later, because either they were not believed or the child didn't know, didn't have even the vocabulary to say what exactly has happened. So I think the first step is to be aware that there is abuse happening. Abuse can be in the form of neglect, physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse. So be aware that these are things that are happening, and that even us as parents, we may be abusing our children unknowingly or knowingly for some situation. So once you are aware, then you can either, you can educate the child, you can increase the child's awareness on what constitutes abuse and who to report to, and how, you know, in a manner that perhaps they can communicate. Maybe if it's a child who is deaf, they can learn the sign language of, you know, like the other day, I'm taking sign language classes, and so we were learning how to sign for rape. So, you know, a child who is deaf should be taught how to sign rape, so that they, if they come to report, they know what to sign for. So empowering your child, whether they are disabled or not, in a manner that is they can understand and in a manner that is accessible to them, how to communicate that they feel violated or they feel that they have been abused. And then we also need to empower our systems, our legal systems. What is the process when a disabled child is abused, especially when they're being abused by their parents? How should, can we have strong, I know we have children's officers in every sub-county, but beyond just sitting at the office and waiting for reports of a child who is being violated, can they do frequent checks? Can they be empowered, whether financially or capacity built, so that they can go to vulnerable homes? There are children in vulnerable homes. We don't have to wait for a report of abuse. We can be going there every week, every 2 weeks for a wellness check. Is this child fed? Is this child clean? Is this child going to school? And you write a small report, and then you go back. The next week, the same thing. But we don't wait for the abuse to happen. Abuse doesn't just happen on that day. Usually the situation around can encourage an abuse to happen. So like if you go to a home and you find a child is being left alone, a disabled child is being left alone in the house, you already know, even if the abuse has not yet taken place, this is a very peaceful situation for abuse to take place. And so we won't wait for the abuse to happen. We will either empower the parents to either get somebody to take care of the child or one of them to stay home. Or if they cannot, then we take this child and put them in a safe place or enroll them in school or daycare or something so that we don't wait for the abuse to happen. So those frequent checkups by social welfare, by children officers, by, child protection services can help to prevent abuse. We've talked about before, is empowering the caregivers and the parents on what constitutes abuse. And taking care of the mental well-being of these people who are taking care of disabled children. More often than not, most people are pushed to perform abusive acts towards disabled children because their mental well-being is not being taken care of. You'll find this abusive parent is probably depressed themselves, or they are probably traumatized, or they were abused themselves as children. So they are simply carrying forward the trauma that they faced. So making sure the people who are taking care of disabled children are mentally well, are emotionally well to take care of a disabled child. Taking care of a disabled child is very, I don't want to say burdensome, but it takes a heavy toll on anybody, but whether it's the parent, whether it's the nanny, whether it's the grandparent, whether it's the community, it's a heavy toll. And so we shouldn't just pray and say, oh, may God give you strength to handle such a child. These are people who should be enrolled in therapy. Like when you diagnose, as doctors, I think when we diagnose a child who might have a lifelong disability, one of the things you must ensure is to refer this parent to therapy. Let them talk, let them share what it means. How did the diagnosis affect? How did they impact it? Did it impact their life? You find a mother who was previously in a very, successful career is forced to give that up to take care of this disabled child. And we expect that mother to be mentally well to take care of the child. Or a father, or maybe there is separation. Sometimes when there's a disabled child, the husband and the wife cannot agree.
Of course.
And then we expect this parent who has been left with this child to be mentally fit to be able to take care of this child the way they ought. These are parents who should be on therapy. Just as the child is on maybe physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, this is a parent who should be on psychotherapy, counseling, to talk out what does it mean to have this child daily, to have to change diapers in a 17-year-old child, for example. It's a big challenge. To look for a school that fits the needs of this child, it's a big challenge. To find friends who can invite you and your child for a social gathering on the weekend, it's a big challenge. And these are things that chip away at the mental well-being of this caregiver. So being proactive about the mental well-being of anybody who is a caregiver to a disabled person can go a long way in preventing abuse in the disabled child.
Yeah. That is so true. And, you know, this topic is very close to my heart because it touches me to the core.
Yeah.
Because most of these things are actually here with us. They're here with us. Thank God that at least you can be able to prevent your child, but most parents can't, because number one, here in Kenya, having a child with special needs, it's an expensive affair. Everything is expensive. The schooling, you cannot even start to think about. Because if your child is able to integrate, then maybe. But most kids are not able to integrate into the normal schools. So being able to get a good special needs school that will understand them. I was having a chat with a parent who took his son to a special needs school, and he ended up being abused in that school.
Yeah.
So you can imagine you trying so hard, and then kumbe you're just pushing your child into a den, you know. It's so tough. It's very tough. So to all parents who are having special needs children, hugs. It's not a walk in the park, but yeah, that's what God gave us, because no one would choose such a thing, but it has happened. So don't lose heart. I always say, if you need someone to talk to, we have a group for people who have special needs. You can always call me. We can laugh and cry together. It's okay, a day at a time, okay? And that's what Daktari has said. May God give. Okay, we all pray for grace, but really, we need the practical things. Please, it's the practical things that really makes the difference. So thank you so much, Daktari. I know I've been ranting, but thank you so much. And it's always a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much for this. I truly
appreciate
it so much. We'll talk more about some of the things I've picked. And we'll see how best we can make this easier for those parents. So asante, Daktari. Your parting shot, please.
My parting shot is that abuse is with us. It's a fact. Children are being abused, both disabled and those not disabled. And we need to be aware that abuse is happening. We need to understand and educate ourselves on what constitutes abuse. We need to be proactive about looking for children in vulnerable situations. And we need to strengthen our legal systems to protect disabled children from abuse.
Yeah. Thank you. And I hope you one day become an advocate for these children. All right. Thank you so much. And everybody who has been watching this, we hope you found this helpful. It's very emotional for me. But thank you, guys, and have a good time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.